TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. This is the post-World War II history of Palestine and Israel as seen through the eyes of one family that had a huge part in shaping it. The General's Son, the autobiographical book by Miko Pellet, refers to his father, General Matti Pellet, a dedicated Zionist. In two wars, as officer in the 1947-48 War of Independence and as general in the 1967 Six-Day War, Matti Pellet helped make Israel into the state and then into the occupier of Palestinian and of Arab land that it has remained to this day. When Matti Pellet was born in Haifa in 1923 to Jewish parents, his nationality was Palestinian. And when he died in 1995, Matti Pellet had been campaigning for almost 30 years for Israel to return the occupied West Bank to Palestine and create two states side by side. In the first part of this talk, Miko Pellet said, "My father did something very interesting. He said, 'We now can solve the Palestinian problem. We can establish a state in the West Bank. If we want to maintain a Jewish democracy, we can't be the occupier.' However, within days of the 1967 victory, the massive settlement program began." End quote. Miko Pellet, in his September 2012 talk in Berkeley, California, remembered how his father tried to find justice and peace for the Palestinians and the Jews by reaching out to the PLO. You will hear in a moment why, in Miko Pellet's opinion, it took the Israeli government another 20 years to do what his father had done, to begin talks with the PLO.
When my father retired from the military a year after the 1967 war, he began a career teaching Arabic literature, but also continued to speak and write about the need to allow the Palestinians a state in the West Bank and Gaza. And he worked as an advocate for Palestinians who were citizens of Israel, the rights of Palestinians within the state of Israel, and he fought for equal rights for them. In the mid-1970s, representatives of the PLO sent by Yasser Arafat himself reached out to my father and several other Israelis, prominent Israelis, in an effort to begin a dialogue, because they too saw that this could be a good solution. But what's interesting is that it wasn't until 1993 that an official Israeli government was willing to actually engage with the PLO. And it's interesting, on the back of this flyer from 1983, there's a little clip, and again, thank you for giving this to me today. This is from January 1983, and it talks about the meeting, a very well-documented, well-reported meeting between my father and Yasser Arafat, and several other prominent Israelis, Uri Avneri and Yaakov Arnon. And these were people that were really, on the Israeli side, the people that used to hold important positions, but they're really renegades. On the Palestinian side, the dialogue was always conducted by official delegates of the PLO. So it really wasn't a balanced kind of a situation, talking about balance again. But what's interesting here is this. The meeting was denounced by both Prime Minister Menachem Begin of the Likud bloc and the opposition Labor Party, which was headed at the time by Shimon Peres. Begin and most Israeli politicians refused to deal with the PLO. It took 20 years for an Israeli government to actually agree to talk with the PLO and begin negotiations. What happened in all those years? What was it that suddenly made Israel agree to meet and talk to the PLO and discuss the possibility of a Palestinian state? I would argue that what happened was the Israeli government knew for certain that there was no chance in the world a Palestinian state could be established in the West Bank because there was no more West Bank. They had succeeded in making the conquest of all of Palestine irreversible. And what they were hoping to do is give Arafat and some of his people little areas to control to make it easier for Israel to go on about its life. People forget that at the best, the most liberal-leaning Israeli government, headed by Rabin and Peres and so on, the best they were willing to do was to give the Palestinians small parts of the West Bank that were determined by Israel, not including East Jerusalem, and not including the Jordan River Valley, which is about a third of the West Bank. In other words, these parts were not even up for negotiations. So when Bill Clinton brought the Israelis and the Palestinians to Camp David in 2000, the attempt was not to come out with an agreement for peace. The attempt was to bring about a complete surrender of the Palestinians. And then Bill Clinton came out and said, well, Arafat gave some, but Barak gave more. In other words, Arafat was not willing to make concessions. And this is the myth that prevails to this day. Let's take a look at what actually happened. By accepting the idea of a two-state solution based on a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, which is an idea that was pushed forward by Yasser Arafat, he, as the Palestinian representative, agreed to give up 80% of Palestine, to give up 80% of historical Palestine for the sake of peace, to give up the dream of Palestinian refugees, millions of Palestinian refugees, to ever return to their homes or be compensated. This is a massive concession. Yet Arafat died with Israeli tanks surrounding him because he was not willing to make concessions. And he was vilified, and to this day, when you hear Arafat in this country, of course, Arafat was this, you know, this some kind of Osama bin Laden. And I would argue that Arafat was the most consistent voice for peace in the Middle East between the mid-1970s until the day he died in 2004. Because he did not waver. He said peace could be established only if the Palestinians could establish their own state in the West Bank and Gaza with East Jerusalem, which again is only 20-22% of their historical homeland. But in terms of the Zionist principles, this is not acceptable, because it's a zero-sum game. For the state of Israel, for the Zionist state, there cannot be any compromise on the issue of the land. And that's why they cannot be a partner to any peace agreement. The two chapters in the book are dedicated to the death of my niece, Smadar. She was killed on September the 4th, 1997, when two young Palestinians blew themselves up in downtown Jerusalem, took their own lives, took her life, and several other Israelis. Now, I was living here already at the time, and it's the kind of tragedy that you really don't know how to express in words. I mean, these are emotions that are absolutely beyond us. I flew, of course, I took the first plane back to Jerusalem. I arrived in the morning, and on the morning, the front page of the morning paper, it already said the granddaughter of General Peled killed by Palestinian suicide bombers. Now, this was big news because he was a famous general, but it was also big news because he was Mr. Peace with Palestine. And the message behind this was, didn't do him any good, did it? See what these Palestinians did to him. Well, my sister set everybody straight. And she set me straight, and she helped me wrap my head around this, and, you know, a lot of us. Because when she finally came out to face the, you know, the hordes of people who came to express their sympathy and mourn, and also the hordes of reporters, she was asked about retaliation and about revenge. And the first thing she said is, look, no real mother would ever want this to happen to any other mother. And if she's anything above all, she is a mother. She's got three other boys, wonderful boys. Motherhood being this uniting force that cuts through all the nonsense of, you know, religion and ethnic differences and so on. And the second thing she said, I point a finger at the people who brought these two young Palestinians to a level of such despair and such hopelessness that they would take away their own lives and take away the lives of other innocent people. This is a level of despair. This is a level of hopelessness. This is a result of the brutal occupation and the brutal oppression under which we, the Israelis, keep the Palestinians. And therefore, she said, I point a finger at my government for bringing these people to this, to be able to do this sort of thing. So, of course, like I said, she set them straight, she set me straight, because it kind of put us on a path. And then she became a celebrity. The LA Times, the New York Times, everybody, the Guardian suddenly started interviewing her and so forth. This bereaved Israeli mother is criticizing the Prime Minister, Israel's Prime Minister. Now, the Prime Minister at the time was Bibi Netanyahu, the same as today. And Bibi was a close personal friend of the family. Was. And there's an interesting side story that I mentioned in the book about how this all, you know, how this all developed. But basically, you need that kind of a strong inspiration in order to continue to live. And so Nurit has been involved and has been very, very active. She just published an amazing book about racism in Israeli textbooks, in Israeli school books. And she's an activist, and she's part of the Russell Tribunal, same as Alice Walker here, and they'll be in New York next month. And I came back to San Diego, and well, what do I do now? I go back to work? I mean, what do? I mean, you just can't do this. And I started looking for things that I could do, and I was very fortunate in that I found a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group in San Diego. And I began going to meetings, and this was the first time I ever sat with Palestinians. First of all, the first time I sat with Palestinians, period. Now, I was born and raised in Jerusalem. It's a mixed city. It's a united city, as we all know. But it's a completely segregated city, too. Completely racist city. So as an Israeli, I never met Palestinians. I mean, I saw them doing yard work and, you know, working in kitchens, but I never met Palestinians. So this is the first time I actually sat with, not only met, so beyond the fact that I only met them, I met them and we were completely equal. They didn't need a permit to be there. They didn't need to be back home because of curfew. There was no army checkpoints that they had to go through. I mean, we were completely equal in every way. And they very gently took me through this very painful process of realizing that my side was not right. And I came thinking, you know, I know everything. With my family background, I know everything. I thought this would be an interesting exercise to meet and talk. And if you're going to go through that kind of a painful experience, that painful transformation, it's like discovering that one of your parents is an alcoholic or a drug dealer or something, or a serial killer. I mean, it's an unbelievably painful process. Then it's nice to have Palestinians around because they're a very supportive group of people. And those particular people were good friends of mine, and they helped me along to realize that not only was my side not the only side, but it really, the truths that I knew were to a very large degree myths. And it took several years. I talk about it now, but it was a very difficult and very long process. Well, after I had gotten to meet Palestinians, I thought, well, let's go back to the old country and meet Palestinians there. So I began traveling and meeting Palestinians within Israel, and I began meeting Palestinians and traveling into the West Bank and meeting Palestinians there. And as I was traveling to the West Bank, this is what I saw. Now it's in Hebrew, but it's red with white lettering, which means danger. And if you've been to any of the checkpoints, if you've gone to checkpoints, Kalandia or any of the others, this sign is about the size of, well, it's about the size of the sign up on the screen. And what it says is this. It says, if you continue on this road, it leads to Area A, which is under Palestinian control. Entry to Israelis into Area A is forbidden. It is life-threatening. And it constitutes a felony. Two exclamation marks. In other words, if the red and white didn't scare you, and the fact that it's a felony and you're risking your life didn't scare you by this point, the two exclamation marks will scare you for sure. And it's only relevant if you can read Hebrew. It's only relevant if you can read Hebrew. Now, anybody with a little bit of sense would see the sign and go back home. Who would continue? Who would go? It's like reading that there's a firing range and you would just keep going. Who would keep going? To my good fortune, I don't have that kind of sense. And I went through, and many of my friends did the same thing. Nobody troubles me. Nobody cares that I'm an Israeli. Nobody cares that I'm there other than the friends that I come to visit. There are no, you know, Palestinian terrorists with guns or with explosives waiting to kill me. There's nothing. And very gradually it began to dawn on me that this has nothing to do with security. That the wall has nothing to do with security. That the massive amount of Israeli forces that stand between Israelis and Palestinians have nothing to do with security. That the horrific humiliation that Palestinians have to go through every time they go through Israeli airport, Tel Aviv airport, has nothing to do with security. This is all part of a racist system that is designed to humiliate and destroy an entire people. And it's meant to keep us apart through fear, through intimidation, through things like this, through walls and so on. That is what this is for. Now I want to read something very interesting to you that I found actually, funny enough, only recently. This is the United Nations resolution from 1973. And it reads that the struggles of people under colonial and alien domination and racist regimes for the implementation of their right to self-determination and independence is legitimate and in full accordance with the principles of international law. I would say the colonial, alien domination and racist regime categorizes Israel, 100%. And any struggle against that is therefore legitimate and in full accordance with the principles of international law. Now in this picture, I'm standing with a good friend of mine, Jamal Mansour, who was a prisoner for many, many years. He sat in prison for many years in Israeli prison. And he was given life sentence, in fact. And he was exchanged in one of the big prisoner exchanges that Israel conducted with the PLO. Now what he did was, he and three others snuck up behind two Israeli soldiers that were guarding an Israeli bank in Ramallah. Why were they guarding an Israeli bank in Ramallah? Who knows? But there they were, fully armed, of course. And these four young Palestinians, this was a long time ago, snuck up behind them and stabbed them to death. Israel calls this that he has blood on his hands. So even though he was released from prison early, he still can't travel and there are a lot of restrictions on his life. And he was arrested many, many times and harassed. But that's besides the point. The thing is this. I, on the other hand, joined and volunteered to serve in an Israeli commando unit when it was my time to serve in the Israeli army. The service was mandatory, but I didn't have to volunteer to a combat unit. I served a military force that was upholding an occupation, an illegal occupation, oppressing an entire nation. Which one of us is the terrorist? This is the question that I think has to be raised. Which one of the two of us is the terrorist? According to this, the United Nations resolution is very clear. Not him. Because I was there representing that colonial, alien, dominating regime that was also racist on top of everything. And I think this is a very, very important distinction to be made. The book ends, the very final chapter of the book talks about, well, how do we move from here? I call it one state, two states, three states. And in the last chapter, my brother-in-law Rami, Smadar's father, who's also very, very active and outspoken against the occupation and so on, talk about the solution. He still calls himself a Zionist and he still believes that the Jews deserve their state and the Palestinians deserve their state. And therefore, the two-state solution is the solution for which we need to struggle. I don't view it that way. But I think it's important to take a look and see how Israel operates. When people talk about the two-state solution, they assume that there could be an Israel that allows the Palestinians to establish their own state. I would argue that could never happen. When you listen to Bibi Netanyahu or other Israeli prime ministers, they will say, and they've said it many, many times, there is no difference between Tel Aviv and Maale Adumim, which is a city in the West Bank. There is no difference between Halamish, which is a settlement in the West Bank, and Haifa, or Jerusalem. In other words, they are one and the same. Which means what? Which means the West Bank is a part of Israel. The life of every single person who lives between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and there are about 11 million people there, are all governed by the same government, the Israeli government. The Palestinian Authority has less authority than a city council. Now, how does Israel do this? It does this, and this is why many people compare Israel to apartheid. Israel has different sets of laws for different populations. There are the laws that govern the lives of people like me, which are completely democratic. I can say what I want, I can come and go as I want, I'm a citizen, I'm privileged. End of story. I'm an Israeli Jew. Then there are the laws that govern the lives of Palestinians who are the citizens of Israel. And you often hear, well, you know, they have it so well, and the Palestinians in Israel have it so well, that number one, they can vote, and number two, they don't even want to leave. Some of them even have beautiful homes. The Palestinian communities within Israel are so neglected that some of them are in worse shape than Gaza. This is one of the biggest lies that is told about Israel, that it's somehow the Palestinian population within Israel have democratic rights. Beyond that, there are over 30 laws on the Israeli law books that discriminate against the Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel. And that's besides the entire culture and the entire environment of racism. A young Palestinian couple who are Israeli citizens cannot get a mortgage. It's not by law. It's just a reality. A young Palestinian couple can't go to a bank and ask for a mortgage. I was told this by a bank manager. They can't get a mortgage. A young Palestinian could have the best grades, doesn't mean he's going to get a job. Doesn't mean he or she are going to get an apartment. They'll get to the interview and then they'll be told, yes, but you know, we'd love to hire you, you're a good guy, but you know what? The guy sitting next to you in the office is from a settlement and we don't want to create any friction, so call us back next year. And there's a sense that Arabs are the enemy. And then there are the laws that govern the lives of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, which are determined by the Israeli military. It's a brutal regime where Palestinians can be killed, they can be arrested, they can be tortured, including children. There are thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners sitting in Israeli jails, in violation of international law, by the way. So the laws that govern their lives, they have no protection under any law. But everybody is governed by the State of Israel. Everybody is governed by the State of Israel. And by the way, speaking of the Palestinian prisoners, over 90%, or I should say it the other way, less than 10% have been charged or even been accused of violent crimes. Over 90% are political prisoners have never engaged in violence at all. These are not hardened criminals, hardened terrorists. These are all political prisoners. And the reality of the Palestinian resistance is that the vast majority of Palestinian resistance has been nonviolent. As principle, by principle, Palestinians have never had a military force. But this image of Palestinians as terrorists was, you know, Israel was able to perpetuate that. Now, can we expect, is it realistic to expect that people will live, an entire population will live under these conditions and not resort to any type of violence? Is that even realistic? That people will live in Gaza, being bombed and massacred from the air, and no violent resistance will appear at all? That's a stupid assumption. That's an insane assumption. What's amazing is how little it is, how little violence Palestinians have ever used. The vast majority of Palestinian resistance has always been nonviolent. But going back to the state thing, Israel-Palestine is one state. It's a racist apartheid state. There's no question about that. It is governed by a racist regime that has to go. There is no way that this racist regime, this state of Israel, will ever allow a Palestinian state to emerge, because it stands in the face of what Zionism is. It stands in the face of what the state of Israel is. The only way forward is to fight against this racist regime, just like people fought against apartheid in South Africa, and just like people fought against racist laws here in this country. And then to create a democracy. Now, when Jewish population, when you talk about this to, you know, when you say something like this to mainstream Jewish audiences, they say, ah, you see, genocide, Holocaust, you and Ahmadinejad. You want to destroy us. The notion that somehow transformation has to be violent is absurd. It doesn't have to be violent. A state can be transformed from a racist dictatorial regime, an evil regime, to a democracy without violence. It's been done before. Multi-nation states exist and do just fine. But there's this myth again that says, you know, if we go against Zionism, if we go against the state of Israel, then we're all Nazis. Which is, of course, absurd. So I would argue, and I'm going to end with this, that the best thing that people who care for peace, and I know many of you have been doing this far longer than I have, is to dedicate the efforts to eliminate Zionism and to work for a real democracy so that Israelis and Palestinians can actually can actually fulfill this wonderful opportunity that they have in living this wonderful country and create something new together. Thank you very much.
That was the conclusion of the one-hour talk by Miko Pellet, the son of the renowned Israeli general Matti Pellet. Miko Pellet continues his father's work with one important difference. His father worked for the two-state solution. Miko Pellet believes that it can only be one state. He writes on his website that his goal is to, quote, help tear down the separation wall and transform the Israeli apartheid system into a secular democracy where Israelis and Palestinians live side by side in a shared homeland. What even for Miko Pellet's father seemed like an impossible dream today has become a necessity, for sure, in the opinion of poet Alice Walker. Alice Walker wrote an eloquent supportive foreword to Miko Pellet's book, The General's Son. She said, "We will share the earth and care for it together, as friends of each other and to her, or we will lose it," end quote. Making the Israel-Palestine issue symbolic and contemporary for so many more that urgently need to be resolved. Miko Pellet presented his book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, in Berkeley, California, at a benefit for clean water for children in Gaza, organized by the Middle East Children's Alliance. Recorded by Jeffrey Blankfort on September 19, 2012. Miko Pellet's website is www.mikopellet.com. That's MIKOPELED.com. His publisher is www.justworldbooks.com. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. Please have a pen handy to write down a phone number to call to find out how to order the one-hour speech by Miko Pellet on The General's Son as audio CD. You can get information on how to order by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.